One cannot speak of the problem with evil without speaking to the matter of divine suffering. You know, why does God have to suffer? Why is that a necessary component to the story? Was that even necessary to begin with? This is especially true with the felix culpa theodicy advocated here. In order to penetrate what transpires at the heart of the unique work of the redemption achieved by the incarnate God, we must take a deeper look into the inner life and the suffering that he had to endure. And to think that this is a short chapter, I understood it fully. No, I had to read it twice because there's a lot here. There's a lot to unpack. And if you don't get it the first time, it just means we got to read more books. We got to understand the implications for our beliefs and not just kind of the easy answers we might want. Oh, Jesus suffered, died. That's a nice story. But there are implications to what that might mean. And luckily enough, 400 years after Christ's death, the councils helped us out a lot. And
they worked through a lot of these issues for us. Yeah.
Yeah. And they didn't have TV or Twitter or any of the things to distract themselves.
So they could spend time doing right?
They had nothing else to do but, you know, eat and survive and try not to get killed by the common cold and all that stuff.
So, Christensen tells us that the Redeemer revealed in the pages of Scripture is shaped by the picture of the suffering servant that's so powerfully brought out in Isaiah, you know, chapters 52 and 53. Yeah. He says the enigmatic portrait of the coming Messiah as one who underwent incomprehensible terrors on behalf of the redeemed is essential, he says, to his greater glory theodicy.
I'll see if I have to find the video and I'll try and link it here. But I've seen Christians go to Israel in the heart and read people. This Isaiah passage to Jewish people, and they go, you know, what do you think about that? And the idea is, well, I've never heard that before. Is that like from a Christian, a quote?
Yeah.
They go, no, that's actually from your scriptures. It's in Isaiah, and it's kind of an interesting lead off to that. So the importance of that Isaiah passage, especially a time and a place where crucifixion isn't happening, the details of it are quite matching with that topological perspective on prophecy.
Yeah.
All right. So, did God die?
Wow.
This is a fun question. This is a fun question that the Muslim apologist kind of try and trap, and
right. we've beat us over the head.
Maybe seeing videos of that is stopping people. Can God die? Well, in your understanding, then Jesus cannot be God, or then God can die. Which one is it? Come on. Well, Jesus did not cease being God in his incarnation or his work of the redemption of the cross. His divine nature is inextricably joined to the human nature in one person. Ineffable deity condescends to life on the earthly plane. He kind of allows himself to be subject to it, and to know and to experience the lowly conditions of humanity, including our suffering.
So notice the first thing he wants us to understand here is that the incarnation, right? Jesus became man. So when we're trying to work through this question, did God die? We need to understand first that God became man. Right. That's the incarnation. That's at least the first step in terms of helping us work through this.
Right. And this lowly condition, this kind of normalcy, we were just reading yesterday for our family devotions in Matthew 13 about Jesus going back to his hometown and going to the synagogue and teaching in these profound ways, so much so that people acknowledge the profundity of what he's saying and kind of the truth of it, but they go, don't we know this person's family? He's just a carpenter's son.
Yeah.
He can't speak of these things. And so their unbelief led him to, by his choice, not perform any miracles. And he, again, a fulfillment of prophecy, even there where the prophet's welcomed everywhere else, except in his own hometown. it's an interesting concept there. So this paradox that's been brought out in this theodicy is hit almost at every stage of Jesus's life is here's the expected, here's the unexpected. We see it in the Old Testament again with oh, it's always the firstborn. It's always the firstborn. Oh, nope. It's always, you know, the thirdborn or the secondborn that comes to fruition here. It's the liar. It's the coward. It's, you know, the murderer. These are the ones that are lifted up even within the scope of, Jesus's own family tree. The two women that are mentioned there shouldn't even be there, including a former prostitute
That's
herself.
Right.
And so, it's just, in one of our episodes, I made a short clip where I said the kind of the unusual is usual as we usually should expect it from a transcendent God.
Exactly.
And so that's what we see here in this kind of two the two in one of Christ's incarnation, and to devalue one is to devalue both of them. Right. And so that's where the hard part comes in, because it's such a unique concept. It's such a unique moment that you can't really draw parallels to. You can kind of say, you know, it's the whole, like, how do you explain the Trinity? Oh, it's an egg thing. Yeah, as long as you say, you know, all analogies break down, and here's the one few times where it, you know, kind of hits on the truth. The
Trinity is an egg thing.
Yeah,
yeah. Okay.
The shell, the yolk, and the white stuff. I don't know, so yeah,
fried, boiled.
Yeah, okay. You can have it many ways. Yeah. You know, that's what Jesus said.
Yeah.
But to save us from suffering, he had to suffer. Okay, did he? Okay, to rescue us from the death, the second person, the Trinity, had to die. How can this be? Does God suffer? Surely the divine being cannot die. That's absolutely true.
Yeah, yeah.